Hello, and welcome to JP Morgan's Global Data Pod Research Wrap. This is Michael Hansen. I'm joined today by my colleague, Murat Tashi. Hi, Murat.
Hi, Mike.
And today we're going to be talking about the U.S. labor market. We published a piece last week, right before the long holiday weekend, called Disentangling U.S. Employment Divergences. And so we want to kind of run through the ideas in that piece, particularly given it's rather timely that we have the jobs report coming up this Friday in the U.S. What we pointed out in that piece is that there's, I think, a pretty notable divergence, in fact, a bit of a puzzle, quite frankly, in what's going on with the U.S. labor market data. Namely, that there are two main surveys that are done to collect U.S. employment statistics. And one of them, which is the establishment survey, survey of firms, the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is collecting data on jobs. That's showing a pretty robust labor market still. We'll get to details in a second. And then on the flip side, you have a second survey, which is known as the household survey, which is where we get, for example, the unemployment rate and some of the details of people being in and out of the labor force. But that also has a measure of employment. And that actually has turned negative recently and is showing substantially less job creation really since the recovery from the pandemic began. So just to put some quick numbers around that, you've got more than 8 million jobs created in the establishment or payroll survey over the last couple of years. You have only about 4.8 million in the household survey. And as I mentioned, if you kind of look at what's happened recently, the household survey actually last month lost 184,000 jobs, and the payroll survey added 275,000 jobs. And if I'm not mistaken, Murat, right, the household survey has lost jobs in four of the last 5 months?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, so it's a notable gap that's really opened up here. And in the piece, we show this if you look at kind of like a three-month moving average and whatnot. So I guess the first place we want to start is maybe just get a little more detail, Murat. You're the labor economist on the team. I'm going to draw on your expertise on kind of what the differences in these surveys are. Obviously, they're asking different groups of people different things, and they're very different sample sizes. So
exactly.
Just want to kind of lay out, yeah, what's going on there, please.
Yeah, I think some observers of the labor market might already know this because this issue occasionally comes up. But these are essentially different surveys. One, like you said, surveys establishments to get a count of actual number of jobs or payrolls in the U.S. And the other one surveys households. To begin with, household survey is monthly like the establishment survey, but it samples about 60,000 households every month, whereas establishment surveys surveys much larger number of establishments. And as such, establishment survey actually has a smaller standard error, sampling error, as opposed to the household survey. So that's, right. You should always keep that in mind. But conceptually, like you said, Mike, these surveys are geared towards capturing different objects, essentially. Like we said in the piece, one is jobs, the other one is people. The household survey, for instance, includes folks who are employed in the agricultural sector, unpaid workers in farms. These are relatively small parts that are not going to show up in the payroll survey, and part of the discrepancy might be to do to this. But the real bigger differences have to do with really two important groups. One is self-employed. Individuals who are not on a payroll of a firm will not be counted in the payroll survey. And that appeared to be a really important driver of this gap early in the pandemic as self-employment initially tanked and then recovered gradually or during the early recovery. Another important component that we find that have contributed to the gap over this period is multiple job holders. So if you hold multiple jobs, you appear in multiple different payrolls, but
only once,
really,
once in the household.
Once in the household, right.
One person, so, many jobs. Yeah.
Exactly. And that might be another important reason behind this gap. And what we find is early during the pandemic, these conceptual differences between the payroll survey and the household survey actually contributed a lot to this gap, but not lately.
Yeah, so I think that's a great point, because I think that's really kind of the crux of how we think about looking at the issue. One of the things I did want to highlight, I think there's a really interesting statistic that some folks may not have seen. It's kind of buried in the discussion of the BLS website. But they suggest that to get a statistically, you know, discernible, statistically significant change on a month-to-month basis in employment from the payroll survey, it takes about 130,000. So you up and down within 130,000, it's effectively indistinguishable from zero. But in the household survey, you've got to move about 600,000 to be indistinguishable from zero, right? So in other words, that plus 275 we had in last month's payroll survey, which could very well get revised, nonetheless is pretty decent evidence of strength in the labor market. But the minus 184 is well within the margin of error. And so we're not sure we should treat that as a meaningful deterioration in the labor market at this point, right? But cumulative, we've seen a number of negative runs. So that's, I think, an interesting fact. And then you also, of course, highlight that there, I think correctly, there are conceptual differences in kind of who counts as employed between the two surveys, because one is asking firms, asking businesses, and the other is asking people. And so as you highlight, there's two key differences. The self-employed are about 6% or so of employment last year in the household survey, and they're not counted in the payroll survey because they're self-employed. They're not at a firm, right? You're surveying firms in the payroll survey. And then the flip side, so that would basically be numbers that would, you know, if you took self-employed out of the household survey, you would get closer to the payroll survey. The payroll survey does tend to run below the household survey. And then conversely, multiple job holders are obviously people who would show up once in the household but multiple times in the payroll survey because they have multiple jobs. That would, you would add that back in. That's about 5% of the difference in the population. But adding and subtracting all these people, so taking out agriculture workers from the household survey, taking out the self-employed, taking out other categories you mentioned, right? So people who are unpaid family workers or work in private households or who are unpaid leave, all of those would subtract from the payroll, and then multiple job holders would add back in. That gap allows you to basically express the data in the household survey on what is known from the BLS as a payroll concept adjusted measure, right? So if you did the household survey with the definitions in the payroll survey, you would get this payroll concept adjusted household measure. And that's going to be the crux to how we're going to look at this, actually, right? Because then the gap from the two headline measures to this measure that we call the, you know, BLS calls the payroll concept adjusted household survey is really interesting. Because as you pointed out, basically the gap between the payroll concept and the kind of, if you will, the headline household number, right? That's the one that tells you how these conceptual differences in employment are playing out. So that's the place in which, for example, you would see an impact from multiple job holders or self-employed swinging things around. And as you pointed out, multiple job holders like kind of collapsed, as they often do in recessions for a time with the pandemic, and then recovered. And then with a lag, self-employed actually spiked up. But really interestingly, it kind of moved back down. In fact, there's a downward trend in self-employed that is puzzling to me. And this is probably a topic for another conversation, right? Because we think like there's got to be more gig workers, there's got to be more people who are kind of self-employed just in general over the last decade or two. And that's actually not in the data. But regardless, what you do find is both of those numbers have basically reverted back to the pre-pandemic levels at this point. In other words, the gap between the payroll concepted measure of household survey and the household number itself basically has disappeared. It's back to pre-pandemic levels. There's always a gap, right? Because as you're taking people out of the payroll survey, you're going to get or out of the household survey to get to something that looks like the payroll survey, you're going to get a smaller number. But that gap has basically returned to where it was, as you pointed out. So the real action there is in the payroll to payroll concept adjusted household survey.
Yes. And that really brought us to understand the gap in more detail. And we think there are really potentially, in some sense, two ways we can explain this at this point, right? Mm-hmm, either payrolls might be overstated somehow relative to the actual or true to whatever you want to call, or a household survey might be missing something this time around somehow.
Understating
the actual level of household employment. Now, we start by looking into potential mechanisms through which payrolls might be overstated. And one...
So, hey, before go ahead. So I'm curious, what was your prior going into this? Was your prior that payrolls are going to be overstated or household was going to be understated?
I think my prior was, I was slightly, I think I would have put some probability to both, but frankly, I was biased towards finding something significant indicating overstated payrolls, to be honest.
Interesting. Yeah, that's fair.
And partly because, you know, I find that unemployment rate as a single best indicator of the labor market, and the movements in the unemployment rate would have been more consistent with essentially slightly muted payroll gains over the recent history, perhaps.
Right. So that's a great point, right? Because we've seen strong payrolls, but we've also seen unemployment rate drift up, right? And that feels inconsistent. Yes.
And we'll come to this, but what we found out ex post about the household survey, I think helps also explain part of that puzzle as well.
Reconcile.
But going back to the, I think, the overstated payrolls case, we really are looking at two different things. One is, and these have been well documented and sort of studied and highlighted in the literature and by the BLS as well, as potential avenues with which, you know, payrolls could be overstated. One is the role of job-to-job transitions have. Now, this is a very, it sounds a little bit technical, but it turns out to be, a significant chunk.
Surprisingly big.
Yeah, surprisingly big, at least given...
certainly relative to my priors.
Exactly. It doesn't help explain the gap, really, at the end of the day,
right,
for us.
Yes.
But the issue is very simple. In some sense, going back to the definition, right, payroll survey is really counting number of people on a payroll in one pay period. Pay periods vary across different jobs. Some, you know, some pays are biweekly, some are twice monthly or weekly, whatever. So what might happen in a very tight labor market with excessive levels of churn, which we have recently witnessed, some people might make these transitions from one job to another and might actually appear simultaneously on multiple payrolls for that reference week. BLS actually identifies this and proposes a simple correction using essentially a simple scaling factor that they think can correct for this reference period adjustment, and also measuring the job-to-job transitions from the household data. Now, for this work, we relied on a recent work by Shigeru Fujita from Philly Fed and his co-authors in computing the job-to-job transitions at the monthly level. And using those rates, we actually computed what could have been the contribution coming from these job-to-job transitions. And it, on average, actually adds quite a bit of, I mean, implies a quite a bit of an overstatement, essentially, 1.3 to 1.6 million per month. But
which is crazy large.
Which is crazy, yeah. I mean, it's huge. But we are talking about 2.5, somewhere between 2.3 to 2.5% job-to-job transition rate for most of the sample period. And if you think about that rate multiplied by the overall number of employed people in the household survey, that's a very large number in every month. So in some sense, it's, you know, when you think about it a little bit deeper, it probably could make sense. However, we find that in terms of month, once we correct for this and sort of generate our job-to-job transition rate corrected payroll, you know, adjustment, we don't find that the recent gap have much to do with this. In some sense, it was a more important, probably significant factor during the period of the Great Resignation, when quits were really high in late 2021 and early 2022. But since then, as the job-to-job transition rate has come down, the importance of this mechanism also kind of disappeared. And then we next obviously turn into net birth debt model, which I know you're...
Well, before we get there... So before we go there, because everyone's excited topic, let me just point out to give again some context for this. There's about 161,000 people who are employed as of February in the household survey. There's about
161 million.
I did that again. Yeah. 161 million. So the idea that you know a little more than a million of them might be double counted in the grand scheme of things is not as crazy as it might first sound, right?
Yes.
So if you put it in the context of kind of month-to-month job changes, it sounds really large, but these things aren't varying that much month to month. And that's the point that you're making, right?
And we should also point out that this, we don't think of this as a kind of a mistake of the payroll survey. I mean,
Right.
this is, payroll survey is still in, you know, intended to measure what it is intended to measure, right? I mean, it's counting payrolls. It's just
Yes.
excessive level of churn might essentially create a wedge between the what's implied by the
Exactly.
household employment levels and the payroll survey.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Okay. So with that, let's turn to everyone's favorite topic, the birth death model.
Yes. And this is potentially another reason why we might have payrolls overstated. This is a process that tries to capture in real time some of the, you know, essentially a problem to capture new establishments that are coming into the universe. Because in real time, it takes several months for the BLS to be able to essentially survey these establishments or sort of keep them in the universe with the right weighting scheme.
So it's kind of like a source of bias, if you want to think of it, right? So it's hard to capture new firms that are creating jobs, and it's even harder in a boom, which we obviously had recently. And there's, you know, you potentially are overcounting the fact that you can observe to some extent that firms are exiting because they're failing, and you recognize that they're losing jobs, right?
Yes, exactly.
Or potentially.
So basically, BLS, and there's no easy way to correct this through survey methodology. So BLS has to rely on a model, and their model effectively spits out a monthly adjustment factor due to this, you know, birth death margin. And for the past, you know, couple of years since the pandemic, on average, this net birth death adjustment has been adding about 120K per month to the payroll.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this number looks pretty large, you know, perhaps. And it's a shift from, you know, around 80,000 or so payrolls prior to the pandemic added to the payrolls this way. Now, that increase of about 40,000 or so might be potential source of overstatement, you know, you might think, but we have seen in our, you know, essentially other research recently and highlighted this in a different context, that there has been a surge in business formation in the US.
Post-pandemic.
Post-pandemic. This essentially implies that the contribution of these new establishments for employment gains could be actually substantial. So based on our calculations, we don't think the additional bump in the net birth debt adjustment over the past couple of years are adding much of a bias in that sense.
Right.
Another way of saying this is, yeah, we think it's essentially given the rise in the establishments and the role of these, you know, opening establishments and their contribution of new jobs, we don't think net birth debt adjustment has been an important source of a bias behind the widening gap between payrolls and households.
Right. And an important part of that story, right, is we can kind of cross-reference against the separate survey, the business employment dynamics data, with significant lag, but nonetheless to get a sense that of what the job creation is, and that makes us a little bit more comfortable. This is not meaningfully overstated, despite the common view amongst the, you know, tinfoil hat crowd that this is a source of just complete and utter overstatement of payrolls. So
exactly, and again, I mean, this is not really a flaw of the survey. This is in some sense a way that the BLS recognizes this this measurement issue will exist no matter how you
for sure,
you know,
if anything it's a correction of a flaw.
Exactly. And then they do their best to correct for this, and we don't think that's really part of the recent gap.
Exactly. So if we take a step back, so far we've talked through kind of two sets of stories, right? One is, you know, who's counted as employed and not employed, you know, self-employed and multiple job holders. Could that explain it? Well, the short answer is early on, those dynamics seem to be important, you know, 2001-ish, 2002, or 2021, 2022-ish. And then, you know, maybe some of this churn in the labor market that leads to this bit of this overstatement, whether through the birth death model or just the job-to-job transitions, that looks like maybe it had some modest contribution. It is really quite modest, right? It's not going to make payrolls negative where they were positive. But that was kind of a thing back in 2022 into maybe early 2023. We've obviously seen some big revisions to payrolls recently to the downside. But again, those are averaging over the last year, maybe about 40,000 a month. So again, that's not going to push you into negative territory to match the household survey. And I think even more importantly, if we kind of look at the history of the revisions, they tend to happen mid-cycle and not like the beginning of the end of a cycle. So it's not obvious those are signaling that the good times are behind us. We can also cross-reference payrolls against other indicators like ADP, which is obviously a separate private survey. There's the quarterly census of employment and wages that is done also off of the unemployment insurance records to try to, reconcile. And that's the basis for the revisions that happened to the payroll survey. And all of those are broadly consistent with payrolls still running positive. The QCEW doesn't look quite as positive. ADP maybe looks a little more positive, but regardless, they're kind of broadly in the same ballpark of payrolls, suggesting that job growth has cooled from where it was a year or 2 years ago, certainly, where we really had those strong reopening dynamics, but it's not the negative we're seeing in the household survey, right?
Yes.
So that obviously flips the question then, okay, if there's at best a little bit of overstatement in the payroll survey, do we have reason to think that there's significant undercounting in the household survey? And I think we've come to the conclusion, and I don't know that we had a strong conclusion going into it, but I think we've come to the conclusion the answer is yes. And immigration is a really big part of that story, right? So maybe we transition to talk a little bit about that.
Sure, yes. I mean, immigration captured, quite a lot of headlines recently.
Yes,
especially
indeed.
After the CBO's revision of their estimates for net immigration for the U.S. and their
forecast. What were those?
For,
they're huge, right?
They're basically forecasting about 3.3 million net immigration in 2023, and the same level more or less for forecasted for 2024,
year.
And then it actually like goes sharply back to pre-pandemic norms.
But the reason that matters, right, is so you obviously in the household survey, you're getting an estimate of population. That's what's helping you to scale everything. And that
exactly.
Estimate is quite a bit lower than what the CBO has, right?
Yes. But in some sense, the implication of this is we might be undercounting civilian population. Hence, in some sense, the civilian labor force, that's going to matter a lot for the recent trajectory of the household employment that's imputed based on the survey responses.
Exactly. And the context here, right, is the CBO number suggests like 2.6, 2.8 million more potential workers, right? Million larger population than what we currently have in the survey.
Yeah, 2.6 million more from the civilian labor force, essentially, effectively.
Yeah.
Potentially in the mix. Now, immigration story, it turns out, so we basically thought the CBO example is actually insightful. And the recent work from Brookings also sort of highlighted this in some sense, in a way.
Right.
And they have compared the CBO estimates to alternative sources of immigration forecasts and estimates from other government agencies like the Census and the Social Security Administration. And they've essentially come up with what are the implied levels of bias into the civilian non-institutionalized population in the U.S. Relative to the level implied by the CPS. And really the one that stands out is CBO. And that's why we decided to essentially just take the CBO baseline for 2023 and the past, the previous 2 years, and essentially do a simple counterfactual. The motivation behind the counterfactual is relatively simple. We can essentially mathematically sort of come up with a simple relationship between the payroll gains every month and the changes in the household survey and household concepts, including civilian labor force and population. So in some sense, we can get the CBO's estimates for what's implied for this population gains in due to immigration, essentially, for 2021, 2022, and last year, and essentially create a counterfactual path for the household employment over these periods and compare it to what we get from the CPS benchmark that we have in the current data. Now, our conclusion is we would Essentially, this would be an important source of a bias and helps resolve part of this divergence, especially recently. Remember, for 2021 and 2022, on net, cumulatively for those 2 years, what's implied in terms of net changes in civilian labor force or population doesn't end up really being that different from the CPS or the CBO estimates. So for those years, immigration doesn't seem to be a, much bigger deal.
It's not explaining the gap.
And anecdotally, we know that, I mean, a lot of the border encounters have actually spiked most recently, especially in 2023. And we forgot to mention that, I mean, CBO's revision to the immigration estimates are essentially entirely driven by non-legal forms of immigration,
Right,
refugees, asylum
undocumented workers,
seekers,
and yeah,
undocumented workers,
exactly.
and all that. So in that sense, I think it sort of like fits to the narrative out there. Now, again, in some sense, we didn't come into this with a prior that immigration might help explain this, but what we found is that immigration can actually help explain some part of this gap, especially
A fair bit.
recently,
Yeah.
a fair bit. But this really still doesn't help us resolve the most recent 3 to 6 months, where households survey essentially started to point towards down. And
Yeah,
that.
because yeah, as you say, well, the challenge here, obviously, right, is if you're adding more workers, that's not a good explanation for why payroll employment went negative, right? Intuitively, if the story is there's more people, not obvious why that should cause there to be less rather than more employment, right?
Yes,
But
in the household survey. Yes.
exactly in the household survey, right?
Exactly. But one counterfactual we did was slightly tweak our this sort of exercise, and this was partly informed by the news stories we have seen that this surge in sort of encounters by undocumented immigrants at the end of the year. We thought if we kind of backload most of this adjustment that we do to our counterfactual towards the end of the year, essentially, add all these additional workers into the mix disproportionately more at the end of the year, then it can help explain part of the divergence in terms of direction in the household survey. Now, again, it doesn't explain the overall gap any more than it did in the baseline exercise, but it can help reconcile some of the divergence in direction that we have seen in the household survey.
Right. So in a nutshell, if we add enough people to the back part of the year, right, which I would argue is not super implausible. I know we've had big debates on the team about this, right? But if it takes, if people are arriving, more people arriving towards the end of the year, and it takes some time for people to get into the labor market, whether it's through legal or extra legal measures, however you want to think about it, right? If there is a bit of a lag there, maybe it's not so implausible that we're getting a bigger chunk of people kind of late in the year. That's obviously where the gap has opened up the most. And to your point, maybe it doesn't really explain everything, but it can certainly help boost a counterfactual measure of the population employment numbers from negative to positive growth.
I mean, we know so at the end of the day, I think this was our conclusion, but we were, of course, now left with a question, Mike, right? I mean, is this plausible? I mean, we know that the CBO's immigration estimates for 2023 and 24 are essentially an extreme case in the
Yes,
history of the
agreed.
recent immigration data. So, how plausible was this? And first of all, and would it I mean, have we seen any,
Anything
case
similar
of
in the
such an
past? Yeah.
adjustment in the past? That was the question that was really puzzling to us, and that brought us, maybe you might want to get into some of this.
Yeah, well, so to your point, right? I mean, obviously, we've seen immigration ebb and flow in the US over time. And one of the things we noticed when we were first looking at this gap that we talked about at the beginning, particularly the gap between the payroll survey and the household survey once it's readjusted to this payroll concept, is that there was a similar gap kind of in the late 90s and early 2000s. If you go back and look at some of the data, there's also a decent sign of a bit of a pickup in immigration them as well. And maybe that's coincidental. But there was a significant restatement of the population data that went into the household survey in 2003 back to 2000. And that actually looks a lot like what we could potentially get now and actually help kind of understand those dynamics a bit better. So maybe, yeah, I know you also delved into this a bit more. So
yeah, so it was really interesting, right? I mean, we have seen, and I coming into this, I didn't, I mean, we know
there's revisions.
BLS routinely every, you know, beginning of the year does a population adjustment to its figures, taking into account new information between decennial censuses and sort of like adjust the level of population in the U.S., hence the household survey. This usually results in a scaling up of the levels, but it usually doesn't affect the rates, like unemployment rate, participation rate, or employment to population ratio. And in fact, in 2003, there was a major revision, but again, to the level of the population,
right.
And incidentally, obviously, then the level of the household employment. This was followed by a similar revision, by the census at the time. And the revision retrospectively sort of revised the level up to 2000. And it creates a huge level shift in 2000. It doesn't affect any of the rates in real time, you know, unemployment rates and participation rates. I mean, it affects just very slightly, almost to the rounding error in a couple of months. But what it does, obviously, it in real time actually narrows the gap at the time.
Right.
And we think, and like you said, there was a similar sort of a higher activity on the immigration front around that time. Now, if we think about how this most recent census was conducted in the middle of a pandemic, it is really not going to be far-fetched to think that there might be a similar adjustment down the road. Obviously, we are not suggesting CPS or the census is going to do something like this. But if they do, we won't be surprised in some sense.
Exactly. Right. And to your point, right, that we've seen this large gap open up. We talked about the outset, right? You know, 8 million versus under 5 million in the household survey over the last couple of years in terms of job creation. This would go a long way to help narrow that part of the gap. It's less clear it would change kind of the month-to-month pattern. So in some sense, we're still left with a puzzle there. And the counterfactual, I think, is an interesting exercise because the kind of the baseline counterfactual we did was effectively a level reset. And sure enough, a level reset doesn't really fundamentally deal with the near-term growth issues. The backloading is not something that we'll likely actually see in the data, but conceptually, the backloading might be more consistent with what's happening on the ground and would be more consistent with the payroll survey, right? So I think in the end, we're kind of left with, immigration probably plays a pretty important role. It doesn't necessarily explain everything. We're still left with this question, which do we believe more, the household survey or the payroll survey to some extent? But there's reasons to think that perhaps the payroll survey may be the better reference. Would you agree that we could, there's easier to come up with the reasons why the household survey might be stronger, meaningfully stronger, than reasons why the payroll survey might be meaningfully weaker. Is that a fair conclusion?
Yeah, I think I agree with you. We definitely need to look a lot more deeply into this, I think.
Agreed.
And the next couple of months and the potential revisions then is going to be hopefully helpful in that respect. But I think broadly, I agree with you.
All right. In the interest of time, we covered a lot of ground here, a lot of interesting stuff to debate. Obviously, we'll see what happens on Friday. We are looking for 200,000 on payrolls, which is right around consensus. Everyone's kind of in that range right now. We do think that we'll see some gradual cooling of payroll growth over the course of this year, but we're not looking for it to turn negative. So we're not thinking the household survey is an early indicator that the labor market's about to roll over. We are looking for the unemployment rate to hold steady at 3.9 and gradually drift up. And so this gets to the kind of that last point, right, which is one of the interesting things about the immigration story, it could potentially reconcile a lot of kind of stylized facts in the data. And one is this idea that, hey, maybe you actually have stronger underlying payroll growth than we thought because of this increase in labor supply. But the labor supply is kind of doing both, allowing for more workers, but also putting a little bit of upward drift with the unemployment rate potentially, right? And so the combination of those two things can coexist.
Exactly. So it makes a slightly drifting unemployment rate with still sizable payroll gains every month more consistent with each other.
Exactly. Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, I appreciate everyone who stuck this out, listened to the details. Obviously, very interesting and timely topic. And we look forward to seeing you again on the podcast soon. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please refer to JP Morgan research reports related to its content for more information, including important disclosures. 2024 JP Morgan Chase & Company, all rights reserved. This episode was recorded on April 2nd, 2024.